Welcome to the Ankler Podcast. This is Sean McNulty from the Wake Up newsletter here at the Ankler, here on Thursday, March 21st in New York City. I'm joined by Elaine Lowe and Richard Rushfield in Los Angeles, as always. Richard, would you turn off the March Madness behind you? I mean, come on, man. We're podcast recording. No time for college basketball.
They're hooping it up. I can't.
They really are.
I'm hooked on hoops.
Wow. I've finally broken through to Richard Elaine. I've got him converted to at least college hoops. So
noted sports fan, Richard. Yeah.
Noted sports fan, the sports enthusiast, Richard Rushfield. So
give me more hooping. 164 games or something?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Richard. Wow. 164 games. So we have a busy weekend to fit in some hoops. So 3 weeks of madness coming up. But before we start, of course, you can catch the Ankler crew, just a reminder here, to catch them on the LA's number one NPR station and Southern California Public Radio's flagship radio station, 89.3 LAist, throughout the day every Thursday as part of Entertainment Thursday during the programming of Morning Edition, Air Talk, and All Things Considered. And you can reach Richard, Elaine, and myself here at the podcast anytime at podcasts@theankler.com. Elaine, do you think, you know, the fact that no one actually works in offices anymore will probably stop all of those pieces that come out every year about like productivity going down when March Madness happens, or not so much?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. March Madness. This thing has started, yeah?
It's going as we speak, Elaine. Trust me, I just turned off my TV before we recorded.
Look,
here,
all so. I know is we're about to start clay season tennis, so that's where my head is at.
No one is talking about that, Elaine. I guarantee
Second,
you that.
But the anyway, sunshine yeah. swing after the Miami Open. No one. All right, fine.
Gotta get that tennis mentioned there. That's it. Every time. I love it. All right. A few things coming up today. Elaine, of course, did her next dive into where the jobs are and, more importantly, what they are in her serious business column this week, which we'll touch on in a moment. Richard looked at Wall Street's influence on Hollywood, which was terrific. Richard, that's a hot take. I didn't expect that at all.
Bringing out the best in us.
Exactly. But a totally positive influence on Hollywood and where the business is at, which we'll dive into that shortly as well. Plus, a look at what I think could be some positive upcoming box office news. Richard may be scowling me at that one for me on that, but we shall see and dive into what's ahead on the calendar. And a lot in the news this week, Elaine. But first, dare I say that you've spurred some jobs talk around town. It's been a popular topic. There was a piece over in Deadline, which was this stat just came, you know, I put it in the Wake Up, but this is a senior vice president at a top Hollywood recruiting firm who estimates that the industry lost about 20% of VP and above roles during the, I guess we call it the purge, whatever you want to call it at this point. And that he, you know, he estimated a good 5% are not coming back. Whether
that
that's
doesn't surprise me.
Job openings or just people losing interest or moving away or whatever it might be. So, you know, that was just a new stat from someone on the inside there. But this is something you looked at again this week in serious business. So what was afoot in your perspective?
So we know that last week when I looked at Disney and Warner Brothers Discovery, about nearly half of the 269 jobs that Disney had listed were tech jobs, right?
Right.
Data analysts, data scientists, software engineers, machine learning people, that sort of thing. This past week, I took a look at Netflix's and NBCU's job listings. And interestingly, out of the 85 jobs available at Netflix, about a fifth of them almost were gaming jobs. So yeah. They're the sort of the anomaly around town when you look at their job listings, which are obviously just a snapshot, right? Like this isn't necessarily going to carry over through the year as a trend. But at this point in time, 3 months into 2024, that's what Netflix is looking for, which I think is interesting because, you know, we talk about gaming a little bit sometimes. It's not really a segment that's large enough for them to break out in any meaningful way.
They don't talk about that much. Really, they do, but they don't, I guess maybe is a way to put it. But
yeah, and co-CEO Greg Peters had said on the last earnings call that it's a huge opportunity for them. They seem to be sort of steadily increasing their investment, but in a very cautious way to see what kind of payoff there are for members first. But I thought that was interesting. Like 16 out of those 85 job listings, at least at this point in time, were for gaming. And then you look over at NBCU, still riding off of that Oppenheimer high, 7 Academy Awards. More of a smattering. I mean, also their jobs portal is a little trickier to navigate.
It's like Nintendo, like cheat codes on how to game the NBCU job board. So definitely check out the piece just for those alone. It sounds like you spent a lot of time on the NBCU job board.
I was tabulating a lot of this stuff by hand, man.
But what was up over at NBCU?
A little more diverse, a little more scattered, some production, some marketing jobs, some finance, legal things. I mean, kind of what you would expect. A lot of jobs over at the parks, which is understandable. And sure. By the way, I was looking only looking at this in the LA area, right, just to set some sort of parameters for it. But I think the thing remains that we aren't seeing are creative executive listings. There was like one over at Disney for a comedy development SVP. There were two VP roles for what appeared to be content, but I think were actually for marketing side, scripted series and unscripted series planning over at NBCU. This is just the market that we're in right now. And listen, like, I have anecdotally talked to studio execs who have not been working for a while, or those who are looking to maybe jump but don't have any opportunities that they see. People who are coming up on a year from the layoffs over at Disney and Warner Brothers Discovery last year. It's been a long year for everybody. And in fact, next week, and we can talk about this later, I'm working on a story where we're talking to people who work in businesses that support production. And it's looking kind of grim there too.
Yeah, that's been a slow start, but certainly, well, probably, arguably you can say that in terms of shows that were already existing or back in production, but not a lot of new stuff going on, especially in Los Angeles, which, well, we'll dive into, we'll get back into that toward later on the podcast for sure. But over at Paramount, Richard, back in the headlines again, are you going to outbid Apollo for $11 billion for the Paramount movie studio? How much you got, Richard?
I'll go halves on that. Check my credit card balance if it still has room for.
You can put it on two cards, right, Richard? Just put it
five
on
and half.
Half.
Yeah,
works out great.
$3 billion each or something.
But the news this week, per the Wall Street Journal, Apollo Global Management PE firm is really back in the conversation now, reporting that they made an $11 billion bid for Paramount Studio. So presumably that's the movie studio, certainly the lot, presumably the movie library, TV library, and just the TV studio business for the most part, although no real specific details are a laundry list here. But what's not in there, Richard? You know what's bad when private equity looks at the linear TV business and says a hard pass? Not a good sign.
Yeah, it's a grab bag of stuff there. And it's not a great sign for the Paramount sale that this is where they are, that the one offer that we've heard about is not even for the whole thing there. So at what point does the sale become a fire sale? And at what point does it get low enough that someone like Netflix, say, or says, okay, well, at that price, sure, we'll take it.
Right.
$11 billion, that's nothing to sneeze at, especially when you consider what the Wall Street valuation of the entire company is, right, Sean? I mean, help me break that down. $11 billion just for the studios.
There was a lot of questions on the math, a lot of raised eyebrows around the math. Yeah, so the market cap of the company is roughly $8.5 billion. That's what Wall Street essentially values it at. That's as of end of trading yesterday, on Wednesday night after this news came out. They have, you know, a good, I think, $10 or $12 billion of debt. So that's, you know, there's carton that is not factored into that. So that, you know, if you're buying the company, or that comes with the, unfortunately, it comes with the company, as WBD has shown us time and time over here. Yeah, but they're essentially, on paper, that's putting a negative value on the linear TV business, that being essentially CBS and the cable networks there. And again, there was no specific list here, Lane, but Paramount Plus is presumably also not involved in that. And that's really not making any money. That's on the debt side at this point.
Yeah, but they're basically saying, all right, cut out Nickelodeon and Comedy Central and Paramount Plus, and we'll give you more for it.
And we will overpay you for this is weighing you down. This linear business is, you know, weighing down the company. And, you know, as I break down all the quarterly earnings reports, you know, that linear business is still throwing off billions of profits a year, Elaine. You know, it's declining, you know, quarter by quarter, and there are obviously major issues going on, but they're not money losing businesses. So it's interesting. It's just, you know, and again, if you want to buy, it's kind of like private. It's like a bundle, Elaine. This is a nice analogy. If you want it a la carte, you have to pay more, right? So if you don't want the linear business and you just want the studio, then there's probably a bit of a markup on that as well, factored in here. So we'll see. You know, you can't choose your bidders. I mean, as Richard kind of put out, there's a sale going on. You know, Redstone has been reportedly very reluctant, does not want to sell the studio. That's something that she was not, you know, keen on. But you can't choose what bids come in through the door here.
And if at the end of it, you have, you know, two or three of them on the table, your shareholders don't love the idea of just walking away from them and saying,
exactly,
you know what, I'd like to keep running the company. So,
yeah, I mean, sure, he does have the voting, the stock, you know, voting power. But there's a responsibility. When a bid comes in the door, Richard, you have a responsibility to evaluate it. And the shareholders, you know, it's not just one person, even though she has the, you know, 77% or whatever the voting stock. But you can't just push it out the door if you don't like it in that sense. It's very hard to do in that regard. So,
yeah. So, I mean, and that can be part of the $11 billion also, that you're putting in a couple billion so that the shareholders can say you... There is no formula where we make where get more than $11 billion in value for this, so you have to accept it.
Exactly. It's making it a must take offer in that sense. So Elena, that also probably factors into your question as to what $11 billion, what, you know, but that you want to make it too good to refuse, not to use a Paramount analogy there. But that Skydance bid is still out there, or whatever it might be. That's more for the National Amusements, the parent company. So, but that's, you know, the only two things on the table. So we'll see what else comes out of the woodwork here, but the latest and greatest at Paramount. But I will say, just thinking about this, Richard, going back in my mind here, does Paramount take the title for the studio with the most volatile corporate history? I mean, you know, the past 8 years of Warner Brothers aside, like, I mean, this studio, there's a current situation it's in. There was the remerge of Viacom, Paramount, and CBS. There was a split of CBS and Viacom, which Sumner Redstone oversaw both. There was the whole Barry Diller, Sumner Redstone blockbuster era, the Marvin Davis Gulf and Western era, Richard. I mean, you know, this is a company that's been sold through quite a few times in the modern era here.
Yeah, it's volatile. And also these machinations, and particularly going way back to the Philippe Dowman era and all that, actually had the effect of destroying the value of the company and leaving it a hulk at the end of all this. Whereas, you know, Warner's, you can make the case that the studio still has assets and potential, that HBO is still a strong brand and all that. But all these backs and forths and the public fights and basically depriving the place of their operating capital for over a decade and a half here, it's left the asset worth a lot less than it would be otherwise.
Yep. Yeah, as we're seeing there. So anyway, we'll keep everyone abreast of those developments as they move along. But over at Disney, a bit of a surprise today, recording here on Thursday. Nelson Peltz got a vote of confidence, Richard, other than his morning affirmations in the mirror, I'm sure. But Nelson, of course, is Disney's favorite activist investor, trying to get two seats on the Disney board for that sweet six-figure payday, I'm sure. Bit of a development. Richard, the hottest new cottage industry in Hollywood, I think, is shareholder advisory services, which have been in the headlines this week. Something that I was not really that aware of until this week, but we've had two major headlines in this development. One of them today was called ISS, new one for the vocabulary. They recommended that Disney shareholders vote for Nelson in the upcoming board election in about 2 weeks. Sadly, Nelson's partner in his upheaval, former Disney CFO Jay Rasulo, was not mentioned by or recommended by ISS. So better luck next time, Jay. And then there was another, quote, influential shareholder advisory firm called Glass Lewis, which came out supporting the Disney board nominees earlier this week, Richard. So this is a new class of company here, or advisory firm to put in the mix here of the Hollywood firmary.
Yeah, Disney seems to be taking this really seriously. I mean, they're buying ads to support their side in this site. I mean, they're really putting everything into publicly fighting against it, lining up George Lucas to endorse the slate and everything.
I mean, Powell Jobs was out there today too. Yeah,
it's kind of a tough case to make. That, like, I don't think there's many people out there that are enamored with Nelson Peltz or his vision, but he's not actually like trying to take over the company and do it. He's just saying we have a different perspective and we should have a couple seats to weigh in on decisions, as they wouldn't be the majority vote. But so it's hard to make the case like, no, you shouldn't be there and you shouldn't get to weigh in, and there shouldn't be anyone other than our board, when the stock has been what the stock's been for the last year, is to just say, no, we're doing just fine. No one else needs to be in the room. Yeah. Got it covered.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's on behalf of the shareholders, Richard, as you say, to increase the value. So that's, you know, that again, it's not a takeover event. It's having a voice in the room there that could be contrarian, or call it what you will. Nelson certainly has a history of this kind of stuff, but a lot of attention on it. Again, the big day for the annual meeting and the vote is April 3rd, Richard. So a little under 2 weeks at this point. And there's definitely Whether curiously timed or not, Richard, I don't know, a lot more talk out there about Succession at Disney and a few more pieces curiously bubbling up around this time here. Jimmy Pitaro, head of ESPN, had a nice big splashy WSJ profile. He's also featured in a new ESPN kind of mini docu that CNBC did on ESPN. It came out today. So this stuff is curiously also coming up in the conversation, Richard, in the mix here.
Yeah, there have been a couple of pieces that have strangely at this moment had details about the succession plans. And the details basically boil down to they're thinking about succession plans because they kind of announced that there's this bake-off going on. And the Red Observer referred to it as a bake-off. If you recall, the last public leadership bake-off Warner's did when Kevin Tsujihara took over is considered one of the great disasters of Hollywood corporate history, resulted in two very talented executives leaving the studio when they were humiliated and passed over in it. So they've announced that they've got these four people and they're looking into them as successors, but they don't say when they would succeed or how they would succeed. And they're not going to announce it and say, like, you are the successor to step into the role somewhere in 3 to 9 years from now. And they don't say that. This group of four, they say these are the only people they are looking at from the inside right now.
Right.
And right. They're not looking at anyone from the outside at the moment. But that doesn't mean they won't look at anyone from the outside. So it comes down to more they are doing diligence in some likely internal candidates should the question come up.
Right. Which any company with the CEO who has said he's leaving in 2020 after 2026 would be doing to look at your internal candidates. So yes, but they reserve the right to bring somebody else in, Richard, I guess maybe the way to caveat it. So a curious thing to note there in all the coverage, and we'll wrap up the news topics here over at WBD. Richard, you brought this up to my attention again, always reminding me that April's the big month for them where the reverse Morris Trust handcuffs finally come off and they can let loose on deal-making again at, check the share price at whatever, $8, $9 a share. But that does happen next month in April.
Yeah, it might be merger time. Two of the studios might well be in the mix. They're acting like they're there to stay. There's certainly nothing to suggest they're packing the place up right now. But, you know, the Discovery Warner, the debt burden of this deal continues and there has to be a way out found to it. And a transaction is one possible way.
Yeah, we go back to that stock price, Richard, again, trying to find ways to elevate, which have eluded them so far. But, you know, I will note, one final note here is, you know, both at Paramount and Warner Brothers, Paramount's been, you know, I think probably arguably the most active on the films front, Richard, in terms of lining up new projects, new films. I just bought another spec script yesterday. At Warner Brothers, I looked at the year ahead, the next 12 months at Warner Brothers Pictures, Richard, and they have films from 8 Oscar-nominated directors coming out within a 12-month period. Like, they've, you know, they're kind of like Project Popcorn. Are you sure that was us? You know, I mean, Mike and Pam came in the door and really at least sent the message out to the town and it's been received. But curious to see what in this age of franchises and everything else that's talking, they don't make new movies, et cetera. You know, that's to have 8 Oscar nominated directors, and that's not even including Tim Burton and Ryan Coogler, who have not been Oscar nominated. So I want to put that as closer to 10 on the slate for the next year. That's something, Richard.
Yeah, well, everyone's just been focusing on the Zaslav Follies.
Right.
There's a slate coming together here, and they have a vision for it, and they have different divisions that aren't even being felt yet. When the revamped DC comes online, they've added to Warner Animation. New Line will continue. And then every week, they're announcing another deal. And, you know, people point out a lot of the caveats in the deal. They're not required to make movies with it. And they're like Tom Cruise isn't bound to make any movie with them. But, you know, they have a lot of people that they're in conversation with. And that's a start.
Yep. And they just announced the animation, back to that point, the new Cat in the Hat film, not till 2026, but that's with Bill Hader. So yeah, very, very active over there at Warner Brothers Pictures. So I broke all that down in the Wake Up this week. You can check out the year ahead at Warner Brothers Pictures in the newsletter at theankler.com. Up next, Richard will walk us through why studio heads are not morons. Richard, do I have that right? That does not sound like you. Is that correct? But we'll dive into how out of whack the reward patterns have gotten in Hollywood and kind of cause things to go askew and explaining a bit of what's been going on lately. So we'll be back in a moment. All right, so Richard, you began your column this week by prefacing, quote, the people who run and own the studios are not morons.
Yeah.
Richard, please, flattery will get you everywhere. I mean, yeah, that's just right off the bat, the flowery praise.
You know, climbing to the top of Hollywood is a really hard, tough game to play. And if you've gotten up there, you've seen a lot of things and you know a lot of stuff. And what I have discovered meeting people, nobody gets there by accident. Nobody just stumbled into the studio head job.
It's not Willy Wonka and here's the keys. Or, yeah, exactly.
And I'll go further. And I think that most of them are in the business because they love entertainment. They love movies. They love TV. They love stars. So they are not idiots and they're not here for evil motives. But they have a lot of things put on their plate that you'd have to ask yourself, well, what would you do if you were in their shoes and all that? And a lot of really bad incentives from Wall Street to think short term, to not invest. And you have very limited war chests. And if you're a legacy studio competing against companies with unlimited war chests, and you have to do a lot of different things with them. And, you know, I want everybody to look in the mirror and say, like, sure, I would walk into this room and say, yeah, you should bet $400 million of the company's money on launching a film that nobody's ever heard of and basically characters nobody's ever heard of, and guessing that we can get tens of million people on this particular weekend 5 years from now to turn out and come see that movie. That's a scary proposition. And, you know, ultimately, that's the job, unfortunately. You've got to pick things and you've got to believe in them and you've got to fight for them. But when we dismiss, like, doing another Fast and Furious or another Transformers, there's a reason why people fall back on these things. And there's a reason why the whole system doesn't want you to be original, doesn't want you to be unique, you know, just says, let's do a whole channel based on stuff from the IP drawers that people have heard of instead of, yeah, let's just take wild swings and see how the world reacts.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you kind of, you know, in terms of the Wall Street of this, the incentives, as you mentioned, Richard, you know, Wall Street never really has liked the entertainment business. It's not something that, I mean, I think the cable bundle may have created an illusion a bit in the, from say, the mid to late 90s through about 2012 when the cable bundle peaked. But I mean, traditionally, Hollywood's never been a bastion of Wall Street. Oh yeah, we want to get in on that.
Hollywood, you are in the failure game. You're in the game where most of the things that you do will not succeed in the best case scenario. And Hollywood is always trying to say, no, we're in other kinds of businesses. We're in theme parks, we're in the cable bundle, we're ancillary, we have subscriptions, we have other things that make this more reliable. But you're making movies and you have no idea in 3 to 5 years from now, these $500 million bets, how they are going to turn out. You can say, like, okay, people love the past 9 Fast and Furious movies, so we assume they'll like the 10th, but you don't really know that. And as we've seen, eventually you hit a point where they don't. Where they just say, yeah, that's enough. Or the chemistry between the stars doesn't work out.
Right.
Or 3 months before, there was another movie that was too similar to that. Or a star gets arrested and can't come and promote the movie.
Right.
Or says something dumb on Twitter.
Yep.
Any of a million things. And Wall Street doesn't like that. Doesn't like
unpredictability.
We feel good about this $500 million bet, but we don't actually know.
Well, for me, the question is, how much more weight do you feel like folks working at studios give to the Wall Street part of the equation now versus 10, 20 years ago? Because the thing that has come up in conversation a lot over the last year, against the backdrop of the strikes and the reason why all of those folks went on strike, is that they feel like the pressure that Wall Street has applied to the studios has been felt to a larger degree than it had the last time around there was a strike, or, you know, over the previous 10 or 20 years. And I mean, I don't have a comp, like not having covered this space like 10 or 20 years ago, but I wonder if, you know, if you're on Wall Street and you're trying to evaluate an industry and you're previously looking mostly at box office, right? Like in an industry that has now largely shifted to TV, focusing on those figures versus focusing on like these streaming figures, would you like seem so readily like set up for the horse race and the Wall Streetization of of like figuring out what's a metric of success, of being able to track those over the last 4 years, has sort of given Wall Street something that feels more tangible to like track to tax success onto, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And, you know, you really, we've talked about this before, but even 6-7 years ago, I never heard about earnings calls. They're quarterly. I mean, this, it was not a front page story. It was not things that people, I mean, it was a general, you kept an eye on the stock price and it had things to do with. But, you know, I think part of it is how much more expensive everything has become, that movies were cheaper, marketing was cheaper.
Everything, but isn't that true of every industry and anything that manufactures something?
I mean,
something?
It's exponentially. I mean, when you're at a place where your $200 million is your opening bid here, you're so far from what movie making at the studios was, but 20 years ago, it's just a different world and what you have to do for it. And also, you have the streaming services. So you have a competitor that has this access to kind of unlimited capital because of that, so who in theory could outbid you every day of the week.
I think also a factor here, Lane, is, you know, again, back, you know, coming back to the cable bundle, but it is still the core of these companies where in the 2000s and even in the 90s, you could, you know, it was just, it's just most, as Richard has pointed out, I've said it, you know, the best business model that entertainment's ever going to think of, and that was the core of it. So even in a rough quarter, you can kind of, the security was there, right? And when the security started, which we all knew, cord cutting, and was starting to wane away, they pivoted to streaming, which was a mirage. So that was the new news to kind of like instill confidence that we know what we're doing and we have a plan.
It felt like much more of a horse race too, when you're looking at these quarterly streaming numbers and you have something, you have these milestones that you can, you know, again, like tack on success or failure to quarter to quarter. Like it brings all the focus there again. And it's like, I've talked about this before. It's like, you think about in 2015, which is, geez, almost 10 years ago now,
right,
when cable was the thing that people were keeping an eye on, right?
Right.
And it was like, what are those subs numbers looking at? And it's like Iger saying that there was a modest sub loss in ESPN, like melted down the whole media sector. And now it's like, who cares about like what ESPN has done in the latest quarter? Like, that's not something anybody pays any attention to.
Yeah. And now that the shift to streaming numbers, which was that moment of, oh, but look at these numbers, forget those ESPN numbers, you know, but that's now fallen apart. Again, unless you're Netflix, you know. So this is the state that we kind of, again, why do we kind of feel in the wilderness here? Because that didn't work out for pretty much all the players here, except for one. And we don't know what the new metric is, Elaine, to point to say, oh, you know, other than our losses aren't as bad, which is not a great, you know, thing to put on the campaign poster. But also, Richard, you know, the reward metric here that you also talk about with Wall Street, you know, so what is success now? And a lot of it is just giving money back to Wall Street. Like, you know, we just give us the money and that's fine. You know, so in terms of share buybacks and dividends, really is what, you know, has become the new metric of incentive. Back to your point about incentive for executives, that is the incentive. That's what moved the stock. When Paramount cut their dividend, that stock plummeted, you know, because that was less money coming to Wall Street. They want cold, hard cash, Richard. They're like, well, we don't believe in your business, but we'll take the money and that's the way to make us happy.
Someday someone is going to figure out how to start a studio that is not publicly traded or take one of these things private. And that, because the problem is long-term thinking and investing in new properties and taking chances on new titles or new things is absolutely not tolerated or allowed here. And
we're incentivized.
If you're going to do that, you're going to fight against the system every step of the way, and if you fail, as you inevitably will if you're taking chances, you will be punished for it at all these companies. The problem is entertainment can't survive, and a studio can't survive unless they do that. You look at Disney and how much of its seed corn that it's eaten, and it's gotten itself to a bad place with film. That finally, the chickens are coming home to roost of not investing in new properties. Everything. And that's a big problem. And it's going to be a bigger problem for everybody if they just keep making part 15 and 16 of everything on into the future forever.
Yeah. And that was, you know, typically that's the way, you know, everybody wants to safest way to keep my job, Richard, right? So no one's going to fire you for making the fourth of something. But if your new idea fails, well, then you're out of here. You know, that's always kind of been the fear out there. But, you know, Hollywood's gone through these, I'll call them
no one's getting fired for Madam Web.
They haven't, you know, certainly not. Right, exactly. But I will say, you know, these things come in boom and bust here, Richard, to a degree where, you know, in the early 80s had a lot of new original ideas and then they were all duplicated to death in the late 80s and early 90s. And then the mid to late 90s was a time of great film, you know, new filmmakers and new talent, new blood, new ideas. And then the 2000s was the 3s, 4s, and 5s parts. And then it became, again, audiences will tell you when we're bored of this, what rose up in the late 2000s and early 2010s. It's like the new Marvel, as we know it, you know, people pivoted to TV, Elaine, where it's like, okay, we're going to, these film talents now went here as their creative outlet. And that was a big creative new, you know, Marvel's based on, you know, IP, but the iteration of it was brand new. And now we've hit this stage again, 5, 7, 9 years later, where the audiences seem tired again. We're in that point where you got to find these hits. But to your point, Richard, if you're not investing in them, making the next Harry Potter film, or if that's the incentive, that's not going to lead you to long-term, you know, long-term success here, because you do have to find, you have to find that next Frozen, you know, that's not going to come out of another, you know, another movie that way. Or Despicable Me was a new idea at some point. That was an original film. And now it's spawned, you know, the most profitable thing in, you know, at Universal. So that's where these seeds are planted, Richard. And if you don't plant the seeds, it's a bad sign for Hollywood, I think.
Yeah. And that's try to get ahead of us, but looking at the box office, you know, there's good movies and there's movies that will do well, but it lacks the depth of the number of releases. And that's had a big effect on sort of the overall size of the audience that's available to pull in. And movie people are telling me, like, everything is just off where it would have been a few years ago because there's just a smaller pool to pull on.
Yep, we'll get into those numbers very shortly. But, you know, maybe if they change the incentive from free cash flow, Richard, to how many billion-dollar franchises have you launched in the past 5 years as your bonus, you know, that may be a way to spur this, but not that I have any confidence that would happen, Richard, but keeping an eye of hope out there. But a great piece, a lot of great big picture thinking there in Richard's column this week over at theankler.com to check out. And up next, we are going to pivot over to the box office, where April may not be that bad. Sorry, Elaine, I think Richard just fell out of his chair. Could you help him out there? I think, you know, I don't know. I'm shocked to hear that, Richard, but we'll be back in a moment to dive into what's ahead. All right, we'll finish out here with the present day movie box office. Well, first, Richard, where do you stand on Ghostbusting?
Yeah, I haven't seen it. People seem to, the buzz.
Oh, no,
seems
I meant in general, Richard. I mean, there's the idea of Ghostbusting.
He's in favor of it.
Are you pro or con?
Who am I going to call? It's, I don't like ghosts. Right. And I'm glad that there's a franchise devoted to busting them.
Exactly. We have the people to call for you. But yeah, what's your take here on the Frozen Empire hitting theaters this weekend?
The whole Ghostbusters resuscitation has always seemed sort of like not at full speed, but this one seems to be getting good buzz. People seem to like it. People turn out for it. So, you know, Bill Murray's out there. So yeah, within a limited universe, why not?
Look, all I'll say is that when it translates to merch around Halloween time, the number of 7-year-olds that I see wearing Ghostbusters costumes going trick-or-treating, I'm like, all right, the franchise lives on.
Maybe they're missing their window when to release this film. But yeah, it is tracking, you know, about $45 million. We'll see where it comes in. That's about what the last one opened to. So not a, you know, a due number, but certainly nothing to sneeze at for $45
Although I took
million.
Your quiz, Sean, it looks like people are not expecting it to hit those tracking numbers.
And check my poll numbers.
It was like 44%, including me, that was like 43 or under.
Oh, thinking a lot of bears out there in this one, huh? All right. Okay. Well, boy.
I feel like that's a reflection of the marketing, though.
More the 7-year-olds not voting in my poll, apparently, who are at Halloween every year. So one of the two. But I will say, Richard, you know, and you mentioned this before about, you know, the box office and the executives saying, they used to be doing a bit more of this, but this will be at least be a weekend. You know, you throw in Kung Fu Panda and Dune, which both are still had about $30 million weekends last weekend. You know, we're going to have a rare weekend. We haven't had this, you know, maybe Christmas this was way, but we have three films doing well over 8 figures in the same weekend, which is sad to say that, but that wouldn't even be worth mentioning, you know, in the late 2010s, Richard. But now this would be it's a weekend where we're going to have a pretty big feat here with Godzilla versus Kong on deck next weekend.
Yeah, it's a little bit of depth for once. And, you know, it's you look down the line and it's a struggle to see how often the depth can sustain itself. And there's some big gaps in between, but we'll smoke them if we got them.
Exactly. But But I will say, you know, and I had that perception, you know, kind of where I'm waiting to get to summer. But looking ahead, Elaine, you know, April is actually not that bad. We have Godzilla versus Kong next weekend, which is tracking at least 60 million. It's going to, you know, doing a big number there. So that'll be another big blockbuster. So, you know, not a bad for a year that was pretty shaky. That's not terrible. It's not amazing, but it's doing pretty well. But looking ahead, the Universal film Monkey Man with Dev Patel, which I thought the trailer was great. I don't know if that's going to deliver or not, but they're going to advertise the heck out of that during March Madness and so forth and maybe get that John Wick crowd out. A24 has a film called Civil War coming out, which tracking just came on in the low 20 millions.
Cue the dads going to the theater.
You know, yeah, from Alex Garland, and you know, renowned and well-loved filmmaker from A24, another studio. But, you know, for that kind of a film, you know, to do, if it opens at $24 million, I mean, that's a very impressive feat. And again, Richard brings movies, you know, it's a movie about something. And just in terms of the cultural conversation, it just brings movies back into that missing kind of part of the movie business that, you know, that center of conversation, Richard, which I think it could do on April 12th. So
absolutely. And becomes an event and becomes something right. That people have to be a part
talk about, which is, you know, kind of a rare bird these days to a degree.
And let's not forget Challengers coming out at the end of the month, Sean.
We have Elaine's movie that Elaine's Tennis Club will be going in mass to, which should really prop up the box office spending alone right there. We have Challengers from MGM.
Look, so if my $16 at the movie theater doesn't count for anything.
How many times? You're going once? That doesn't sound true at all.
Repeat viewing. I'll organize viewing parties, Sean.
Yeah, mom can't hang out that weekend, kids. Sorry, she's she's going away with her friends. So, but, you know, it's a great test for Zendaya, so we'll see what that brings in. So, you know, that's three films. And again, three films that have young talent, that are fresh filmmakers. This is not, you know, all due respect, the 80-year-old filmmaker being another movie back to the theaters, which, you know, it could generate some excitement, Elaine, among the younger demographics. And that is, again, the conversation about new things. There's not even, you know, there's no sequel here. These are all three original ideas that could dominate the box office conversation for April, Elaine, which is, you know, that's quite a feat.
Yeah, that'll be nice to see if it happens.
Yeah, and leading into summer with The Fall Guy from Universal kicking off on May 3rd. So we shall see. But I'll, of course, break all that down for the Ghostbusters numbers this weekend in The Wake Up on Sunday night. And Elaine, what's up for series business on Monday? So you're looking more at a different sector of town and employment, right?
Yeah, talking to businesses that, frankly, sometimes feel forgotten in the mix, those that are supporting production. I visited a couple of prop houses this week, talking to folks who work at other kinds of studio vehicle rentals, that kind of thing. And, you know, really trying to get a sense of what the business looks like from their vantage point. You know, we hear a lot from the folks on the studio side. We hear a lot from writers. I'm curious as to what the reflection is on the amount of production happening right now and what their outlook is for the rest of the year. Spoiler alert, it's not great.
Not a lot of optimism out there? Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can check that out on Monday as part of Elaine's series business column over at theankler.com, which you get as part of your Ankler subscription. Also, just to mention to check out a new series business column dropping today from Minori, looking at the increasing difficulty across the pond for UK actors and agents, as well as below the line workers, whose union called Bechtu just surveyed their members about who's back to work post-Hollywood strikes. And the numbers were pretty alarming. So Minori gives a great overview on the big challenges that agents are having getting work for their clients in the UK market, what the outlook is in the months ahead, as well as what areas people are turning to for work. You can check that out over at theankler.com. Of course, you can email us anytime at podcasts@theankler.com and follow The Ankler on the socials at The Ankler. Richard and Elaine, a pleasure as always. And of course, a big thanks goes out to you for listening. We'll see you next time.